This is Current State on WKAR, your weekly radio news magazine, checking in with all news and stories from across the Capital Region. I'm your host, Peter Wharf. 24 people ran for seats on the Lansing City Council this year. This weekend, we know only 8 will go on to compete in November. WKAR's Reginald Hardwick tells us about the candidates who will be going forward.
This November, there will be 2 at-large seats to fill on council. The top vote-getter in last Tuesday's primary is Lansing School Board member Peter Spadafore, who told WKAR's Scott Pohl earlier this year he wants to focus on city infrastructure.
I drive through the neighborhoods. I drive through the other areas of the city that are not downtown and see roads that are, you know, damaging vehicles, that are dangerous. Sidewalks are the same way. I walk my dog and have to jump over the uneven sidewalks. So that type of infrastructure really needs to be a focus. And you'll see that around the state, I think. But we need to get serious in Lansing about a long-term plan that puts money invested into our infrastructure so that we have a place where people want to live, raise their families, and work.
Council incumbent Kathy Dunbar is seeking to be reelected. She garnered the 2nd most votes last Tuesday. She wants to focus on the economy.
It's been a recession economy for most of my time on council. And a lot of the incented developments are coming offline as far as the incentive, and they're coming into full tax mode. They're paying their taxes. And we have others that are coming due in the next 5 years. So that's going to drastically change the environment as far as our revenue and what it can be invested in. And I really want to see a lot more job creation. We've done good staying afloat during the recession, but there's a lot of growth that can be done.
Also seeking an at-large seat is another Lansing School Board member, Guillermo Lopez, who says neighborhoods need help.
I think that it is time to refocus and look at our neighborhoods and how best we could serve them. I think we need to look at development of neighborhoods, empower our neighborhoods in different ways. I think we need to concentrate city services to help our residents. If our residents are not happy, Lansing will not prosper. The service needs to be there for citizens so they can feel good about Lansing. We need to look at how we can fix the potholes, how we can fix the sidewalks.
And the candidate who received the 4th most votes is Michigan State Police First Lieutenant Kyle Bowman. He says Lansing is a safe city, but more needs to be done.
You know, no one wants to have to call the police 911. They actually want us to prevent that from happening in the first place. We want to avoid having victims in the first place. No one wants to have to try and recover from having your home broken into or your vehicle stolen. Those are very traumatic things. And I've been a victim of crime as well. And that's one of the things that frustrates me when I see that a service isn't being provided the way that it should be. I do think it's a safe community. I think individual police officers that I know with Lansing are amazing people. But there is work to be done.
Meanwhile, the City Council Ward 4 race is down to attorney Brian T. Jackson.
Safe communities is very important to everybody. It improves quality of life for residents, and I think that's what the main thing that people want to see. And one thing I would do is I would push for better community policing. I would push for implicit bias training. I would push for mental illness training, and I would push for de-escalation training.
And Park Board member James McClurkin.
If you live in the 4th Ward of Lansing, there's not a single grocery store at which you can shop. There are a handful of small convenience stores, none of which are known for their healthy food selections.
You think the city council can facilitate bringing a grocery store into the ward?
I think the city council has to be the place where everything starts.
The Lansing City Council Ward 2 race comes down to union leader Jeremy Garza.
Well, I believe there's a lot of parks that are closing. The roads are terrible. Infrastructure, you know, I think we need to clean up our commercial corridors, our neighborhoods. You know, our parks are being left to decay.
And 8-year incumbent Tina Houghton.
I'm a pretty sensible and rational person. And I think being able to work, you know, you say both sides of the aisle, any side of the aisle, is very important. And I think I've been able to do that quite well.
Look for a lot more campaigning before Election Day on November 7th. Reginald Hardwick, WKAR News.
You can hear extended interviews from all those Lansing City Council candidates at WKAR.org. Search Election 2017. Thank you. Current State on WKAR. In the 19th century, women's exchanges formed a national network that created economic alternatives for financially challenged women in a world that permitted limited employment options. Women's exchanges are one of the nation's oldest continuously operating voluntary movements. Many are still in business after more than a century. The Women's Exchange took root in Michigan, in Detroit, during the 1880s. I got the chance to speak with Northville writer Michelle Fecht, who told the story of the movement in her Michigan History magazine article, The Women's Exchange of Detroit.
It originally started to help genteel women who had fallen on reduced circumstances, so you could assume it was widows or some other, you know, circumstance that put them in a position where they had no means. And it was actually a very prominent Philadelphia woman by the name of Elizabeth Stott, who started a Philadelphia Ladies Depository as a marketplace to help these gentlewomen sell needlework, which was something back in the day that most women did, and realized that when they tried to sell it on the marketplace, you know, often stores, merchants were men and were offering them pennies on the dollar. And she thought if these women had an opportunity to really sell their fine work for market value, they could sustain themselves. So that's how it started. And I think you certainly had a period as the movement took off, especially in the post-bellum period after the Civil War, where you had so many war widows and so many women who really were not going, there were so many deaths that the unmarried women, I think, was unprecedented after the Civil War. So what were these women to do? So the movement took off then, and then it became, in the 1870s, the late 1870s, it became more of an effort to include all women of all social classes.
And it seems to me one of the important things, Michelle, is that this was a movement for women by women.
Absolutely. That's exactly what it was. You had very socially prominent women, and that certainly was the case almost at every exchange, certainly in Detroit as well, who felt that this was an opportunity to help the sisterhood, so to speak. And, you know, certainly in Detroit, the early stories about it that were heralded in the newspapers, the Detroit Free Press and the Detroit News and the, you know, now defunct Detroit Journal, talked about these very prominent women that formed this and were helping, you know, their sisters, so to speak.
So the Women's Exchange began by helping women to sell some of their skilled work, such as needlepoint and maybe, you know, other quilt making and those sorts of arts. But as you mentioned, catering comes in. What else is added to the lineup of the Women's Exchange? You see some lunchrooms begin to happen.
Absolutely. I think it started out, like you mentioned, as, you know, needlework, which I think is something that women did. But it moved on to other home arts, things like china painting and things like that, you know, making lampshades, other sorts of home arts.
Take us to that scene in Detroit. It started at a florist and then moved on to its own building right downtown to what's now a present location right near the ballpark.
Yes, Charlie's Chili Bar, as a matter of fact, is now there.
Charlie's Chili.
It actually started out, it shared space with a small floral shop on Woodward Avenue. And from the time it started in 1889 until 1916, it was probably about a half a dozen times to different locations. And then it was in 1916 that they built their own building. They took two structures that were on East Adams and combined them into one, and the very prominent firm of Smith, Hinchman & Girls designed this. It sort of is in the English style. It was actually based on a a butcher's hall in England, so it has that is kind of a replica of that, which it still does have today. And they opened this amazing three-story facility that had a huge dining room, but also had a place for its wares, its needlework department, very departments within the building.
And right away they had a fire.
Within two weeks of opening on February 1st, 1916, they had a fire that completely gutted the second and third floors. But they were undaunted. They rebuilt, and I think they had their most successful years really in that period between, probably about 1916 until the late 1930s into the very early 1940s. It closed in 1942.
Have you visited any other places, or are you aware of any other women's exchanges that are still operating?
Yes. I think probably one of the most renowned that's still in existence and frankly thriving is the Women's Exchange of St. Louis. And it was established in 1883. It has a very prominent tea room that is still the place to go. And it has a very distinctive little dress for little girls called the cherry dress. I mean, the New York Times even wrote about this back in, I think it was about 2008 or 2009, a little white cotton frock dress that has little cherry on their enclosure snaps. I mean, even little John F. Kennedy Jr. was seen wearing a little kind of a bib overall short outfit when he was tiny with his mother that was from that exchange. And it's still very prominent today. So there's exchanges in places like Scarsdale, New York, and, I think there's about 20 throughout the country that are still thriving.
Michelle Fecht is the author of the recent Michigan History Magazine article, The Women's Exchange Comes to Detroit. Michelle, thanks a lot for this fascinating historic conversation about the Women's Exchange in Detroit and beyond.
Thanks so much, Peter.
For Current State, this is Peter Wharf. You're listening to Current State on WKAR. This is Peter Wharf. The Great Lakes Folk Festival is happening on the streets of downtown East Lansing as we speak. Sponsored by the MSU Museum, it brings together different cultures, music, food, stories, and a connection to Michigan. WKAR's Reginald Hardwick is here now with a guest who can explain why folk festivals are still important in this world of smartphones and social media. This year's festival expands on some of the music samples you'll hear, too.
Joining us now is Dr. Mark Oslender, Director of the MSU Museum and Associate Professor of Anthropology and History here at MSU. Hello.
Hi, Reginald. It's great to be here.
And tell us a little bit about the Great Lakes Folk Festival and, what can we expect there?
Well, the MSU Museum has been putting on this folk festival, the Great Lakes Folk Festival, with the help of about 100 volunteers and lots of artists for the last 16 years. But we've actually been organizing folk festivals since 1987. So this is really the 30th anniversary of the festival that we're going into this weekend.
What is the need to kind of collaborate and see these different, aspects of life?
It's a great question. I mean, in many tradition-based societies, my research is in Africa. I work in villages, and I do a lot of historical work also on village life in African-American communities here in the United States and in other places. So it's really a modern idea, funny enough. It's a paradox that it's only in the modern world that we worry so much about tradition. And it really has to do, after World War II, with new forms of residential development, the fact that everybody had now access to fast food and big box stores and things like that. You could travel across the country and think for a while every place was the same. You just keep on getting deja vu. Every suburbs look the same. And with that, we start to see a rising in the 1960s and 70s especially, an enormous desire for something else in life, a desire to be reconnected to a place, to have a sense of a deep specialness. And that's really where folk festivals arise, a return to the labor of the hand, creating artwork and new kinds of activities that come out of life on the farm or on a fishing boat or wandering through the woods and whittling something and so forth. So a folk festival really speaks to our deepest longing as human beings, especially in the modern world, for deep connections to the past, to the future, something that will tie the generations together, something that will remind us of what it's like to feel at home.
There's something that's a little different with the flavor of the Great Lakes Folk Festival that you wouldn't find, say, in L.A. or Miami or
That's a great point. Of course, there are folk festivals all over the country. I've been very involved, as have a lot of my colleagues, with the National Folklife Festival on the National Mall. But there are some special things about the Great Lakes Folk Festival that have to do with our particular identity here in this part of the country. A long history that goes back to farming and immigrant communities, the maritime experience on the lakes itself, so some of the music reflects that, the particular melding of cultures, the story of the African-American Great Migration so profoundly transformed Michigan from World War I into World War II and beyond. All of that is really reflected in this fantastic, almost dizzying array of cultures and exchange that does make our festival, I think, different and distinct from anyone, say, on the coasts.
We do live in a modern world with social media and cell phones and the way we interact and everything. Do you see more of a need for folk festivals now more than ever, or has it changed at all?
It's a fascinating question. Yes, we do have access, of course, through the marvels of the internet and mobile devices. In an instant to any musical form around the planet through iTunes or all sorts of other music sharing devices. But what we find is that there is a deep longing for liveness, for being really present. There is nothing when you're with a great artist, especially one who's, whether or not they're from Ireland or from Appalachia or from the Delta blues performer and so forth, to be in their presence. Partially because you can get a sense of improvisation. You can go up and ask them questions. You can throw out a request, and who knows what'll happen.
Louise, you're the sweetest gal that I know.